Ancient words. Changing me, changing you. Man, what a challenge. I don't know how well I'll do this week in presenting what I want to say and expressing it in a way that's clear, but if I don't accomplish some of that, changing you and changing me, I don't think we spend our time very well. And I hope you'll find in each lesson maybe an opportunity to evaluate where we stand in comparison to God's plan with regard to family and with regard to our roles in the family. That's what I want to look at. I'll just say, you know, Gary said, you know, why don't you come and talk to us about some of the stuff that you had done related to men's leadership that I've done with the camp. And so I sent him maybe 8 ideas of things that I might be able to develop. So he, of course, typically just said, okay, come do them all. He figured out how to arrange them through the weekend so that we'd have a mixed group and then men in the morning, maybe parents and couples later. And I hope it will be useful. I feel inadequate in a lot of ways, not being a full-time preacher and having worked all my life in some ways as a missed opportunity to maybe spend as much time in the Word as I should have. Not that I did as much as I should have anyway. But despite that, I hope you will listen to me. And I also am more of a teacher than a preacher. That'll be pretty clear. And it will help me if you'll answer questions. The reason is I'm just insecure that anyone's paying attention or even is following what I'm saying. And so if you just, even if the questions are just uniquely trivial, and it's almost like you feel stupid answering such a dumb question, please do it anyway. And think of it as something like accommodating a weaker brother or something like that. So I'll have some sense that somebody's paying attention there. And the other thing is, I can't stay behind this mic. Would this work? Can you all hear back there okay? And if you can't, do this or something. We'll work it. So I've played with different titles. We didn't really agree on anything. I like the idea of using the term creating godly families for reasons that I hope you'll see. That is, it's something that we can, with God's help, make that isn't there now. It is not our natural way to be godly in our nature or our families. If we follow the ways of the world, it is an unnatural thing that we actually may face opposition. For sure, confusion from the world. So it has to be put in place as an active measure. I'll say it in a different way. We're in a war. That will be one of the themes this weekend. Everything works against us in this fallen world in which the whole world lies under the sway of the evil one. And if we're not working against that, as warriors, as courageous warriors, we'll fail. Now, we have the help of God, of course, but we have to see it as a struggle. A struggle that God has won the victory, but we're striving to share in that. And it's perfected at the end of time, but still it's something, it's an act of creation on our part. And tonight, we want to look at the origin, the actual original creation of the family. The man and woman unit that we call husband and wife, that one flesh blessing that God placed in the earth, and how they related to that world in which they were placed, right? You know those folks, Adam and Eve and the story. Ancient words, which I hope will be changing you and changing me. Tomorrow morning, for a couple of sessions, we'll talk about the roles assigned to men, looking at their temperament, how it might be seen as different. We'll see a little bit of that tonight, but also what a fallen world has done to us as men and how it tempts us to use some of those things that maybe God put within us but with a different purpose, and we tend to use it in the wrong way. How can we redirect it as men and use that male temperament in the battle, the real battle, the spiritual battle that God's given us to fight? And then tomorrow afternoon, a very brief summary, probably be maybe a couple hours, but looking at the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And it will be just an overview of that book, kind of a look at how it's structured, its major themes and messages, and I hope a whole bunch of potential applications, which you can pick and choose from, but hopefully will make a difference in your relationship. Saturday, tomorrow night, we'll talk about really in a way a continuation of this lesson, which is looking at how families can be built in a fallen world. Recreate is the theme I'd like to follow there. We are a new creation. I wonder if as God's new creation, He made us alive. We were dead. We're recreated. We have the breath of life breathed into us, His Spirit, just as Adam and Eve did. What does it do to our families? What can it do for our families? That's tomorrow night. Then, teaching children Sunday morning, looking primarily interpreting kind of a couple of the Proverbs in a specific way, as I think a practical way of deciding how discipline can be managed. And then Sunday is a mystery lesson. You'll have to come and see. What is the secret of successful leadership? Right? What is the secret? I'm going to reveal that secret Sunday morning. And it's not in your outline book. If you need an outline book, there's some in the back. That sermon outline is not in there. You will have to come and hear the secret of successful leadership. It may be worth a whole weekend, really. One secret. And then Sunday afternoon, maybe one of the more bizarre sessions, is a look at perhaps, I'll call it since I like math, an algorithm for how to do Spirit-led decision-making, looking at the example of the Apostle Paul. So there's a weekend right there. All right, help me out. Let's get started. Here's a warm-up thought. Who wrote the book of Genesis? I told you these would be easy questions, right? Who wrote the book of Genesis?
Moses.
Thank you, Gary. You set a good example there. For answering the question. And who did he write it to? Yeah. And where were they kind of at the time that all five of those books really were put together, Moses? Where were they? Okay, somewhere. They weren't even to Canaan yet. They were a new nation. They were kind of like fresh out of slavery, you might say. And now Deuteronomy fast forwards, you know, to a kind of a new generation. But in general, Genesis, you have to think, was maybe written to a people. Why was it written? These questions are getting a little harder, maybe, each one. We know to whom, who wrote it. But why would Genesis have been written? I mean, is it about the Israelites, really?
It's probably more about God.
Okay, so it's a revelation of God's nature. There's a whole lot of details in there about people, names and sons and, you know, trips and, you know, dilemmas that these sons, so-called patriarchs, got themselves into, and mistakes they made, and, you know what I mean, all of that. And then, you know, of course, Adam and Eve were way long before the Israelites. What's that in there for? Right? What? Just thoughts about that. Maybe here's a different question that would be helpful to answer the why question there. What might, in coming out of Egypt as slaves without really much of a culture, unifying culture of their own, what might have been the source of the Israelites' concept of God? And the creation account, the creation story, the mechanism of creation, and family structure, and what males and females are with respect to each other. What might have been Israel's source of information about that?
Oral tradition.
Okay, maybe there was some oral tradition, but it seemed to me very likely that the Egyptian mythology, of which there were many, apparently they varied from city to city in Egypt, and some of them were really bizarre. Apparently, there's one city that said that, you know, the sky and the land or the sea, the sky and the water, I guess, there was a brother named Shu, I think his name was, and his sister was named, I had to write it down, it was something like Tupset or something like that, and one sneezed and the other one spit, and that's how you got air and water. You can guess which one, Shu or Tupset, was the one who sneezed and the one who spit. But there were things like that. Some of them are not even really appropriate to talk about. But that might have been part of what the Israelites had as their heritage. And if you had that as your heritage, how might you behave with regard to families or worship of God or other things? Would it affect the way you behave? It definitely would. Is it possible that we're kind of in the same situation in our world and culture about what we think about God, about how humans got here, about male and female and how they got here, about how families ought to be structured if all we listen to is the world around us? This is the famous evolutionist. Here's a quote. Here's his explanation of, say, romance and male-female relationships. He says this is Julian Huxley. Courtship in animals is the outcome of four major steps in evolution. that affect you, the way you viewed yourself and relationships. First, the development of sexuality. Second, by the way, I think that's one of the hardest things to explain by evolution. How you end up, if there was some organism that could just recreate itself, somehow or another evolved or devolved, I'm not sure, to a being that had to have somebody else different from it in order to recreate. How would you explain that in terms of some incremental evolution? I don't know, but he passes over that. First, it was the development of sexuality. That is, secondly, the separation of the sexes. Yeah, I guess so. Thirdly, the internal fertilization, or at least the approximation of males and females. And finally, development of efficient sense organs and brains. Without any one of these, there would never have existed that host of strange and lovely features of life summed up under the head of courtship, which beautify the appearance and variegate the existence of so many of the higher animals, including our own species. If that's your view of how we got here, would it affect the way you kind of thought about families, about males and females, about moral behavior generally, or if that word morality even means it? I'm telling you, brethren, I think that's the world we live in. We need to have the message that the Israelites got. No, there's a story. It has lots of meaning. And it's very important. It's one you could never have guessed or made up on your own. But boy, does it inform our behavior. It should be essential to what we think about families. And so we want to look at this creation story of men and women and see if we can't learn something, even apply some lessons tonight as we do that. God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the cattle, over the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves on the earth. God said, see, I've given you every herb that yields seed to which is on the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed to you, it shall be for food. Remember that for later. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I've given every green herb for food. And it was so. You probably have thought a lot about what it means to be created in the image of God. You can already begin to see hints in this text. Were Adam and Eve given things to do, according to this text? Yes, I mean, in fact, I think the first thing about having dominion that's listed here in verse 26, that seems like a tough challenge to me. Doesn't it? Do you think you'd have to have courage to do that? A measure of physical strength and endurance to do that? Some sense of strategic thinking, planning, implementation, and management of the plan? Is it possible you might try something and fail? And try again and try again, and you have to have some degree of stubbornness or at least determination? Is that a possibility? I know I'm way out in space here, but that just seems like a big challenge to me. It wasn't that they had nothing to do. I would have set up a hammock right away in the garden. But that's not, it seemed like it was something to do. And the garden itself had to be taken care of. And they were uniquely qualified. You begin to see that here in that, were they also supposed to be fruitful and multiply? I think there's this sense of recreating yourselves in larger spaces. We'll see later in the book of Genesis that becomes an issue. Okay, so there's the beginning of it. God planted, or the Lord God, planted a garden eastward in Eden. There he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground, the Lord God, this is chapter 2, which is a reprise of what had been covered. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now there's an interesting introduction there. The Lord took the man and put him in the garden to tend and keep it, more tasks to be done. And I like this, out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. I guess what we usually say the reason for that is, why did he bring all those animals and show them to Adam?
So none were suitable companions.
Yeah, certainly that's the conclusion that he came to at the end. They're not suitable for you. But it's interesting to me that Adam was naming the animals, the animals were not naming Adam. Now that seemed like a silly point. But there's language implied there. Have you ever thought about that? I wonder what he called that furry thing that goes. He might have called it "Pay Me Out." I don't know. But that sequence of sound waves is not a cat. It's an abstraction of a cat. You see that? And later, maybe scribbles on a page. They're not the same as the object, but man has the ability to build those abstractions and communicate in various ways. And right away, you see there's some commands that are kind of prospective about what might happen and something else that might happen. And if that happens, then a consequence follows. You see, that's abstract thinking. And right away, man is seen as superior to the animals, not only because he has dominion over them, but he's naming them. He has dominion over them intellectually, the ability to call them by names and plan about them. And God can give him commands which suggest a sense of right and wrong and all those things that make us uniquely human over the animals. You see what's happening here. Boy, if I was an Israelite, that'd be important to know. If I'm an American today in our society, that's important to know, that I'm a moral creature created in the image of God with choice and the ability to reason, that I'm not an animal and I'm not subject. I'm subject to the same natural laws, but I have other laws that the Creator God has placed within me. Well, so the first woman was created. There was no helper comparable. Does that suggest already a role relationship? I guess Adam had the job of having dominion or taking care of the garden, whatever else he was doing. I think she would be better at naming the animals, but she wasn't available at that point. But anyway, but she was a helper comparable to him. And she's flesh of his flesh. And we learn in chapter 1, also in the image of God. And so therefore, verse 24, and this passage will come up again three times in the New Testament to have some specific lesson for families and relationships. And be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. I'm pointing to verse 24 here. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Let's see if we can kind of think about that. That particular incident there is kind of referred to in the New Testament. And really, the events before the fall, the woman made from the man, Adam formed first, leaving, cleaving, one flesh, those are used in the New Testament to describe different principles that we follow. And it goes back to the very creation, before the fall. Now, sure enough, in 1 Timothy 2, there is a reference to Eve being beguiled, but those other three really are not a consequence of the fall. They were just the way God made them. And those references in those texts have to do with a pre-fall world. So there's already a role relationship implied, even in a sinless world. Even in a sinless world. And you can see it, maybe we can draw it this way. There's man. He's all by himself. There's no helper suitable. So woman is created as a helper. Well, what was Adam? And of course, then that union has a uniqueness about it that's separate from the former family that they both came from, and that's referred to as one flesh. So now we see this union. Now, what were they supposed to do? Well, they had a task, and it related to the outside world, and that was to till the garden, to have dominion, those kinds of things. Those look outward. Command given to Adam, but I think this helper was going to be important for him. And the other command they were given, which we saw, is to be fruitful and multiply, so there would be children. I think it's true that both of those had to be done together, right? I think Eve was a helper to Adam in his job of having dominion. Certainly Adam had to help Eve with his business of having children. But you can see each of them maybe had a primary role in each of those. She's a helper to him. She enables her to have children as they're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. By the way, at about quarter till, I want to make sure we get to the application part. So I may skip some stuff. That's part of the reason we're handing this stuff out, so maybe later you can look at it and puzzle over what I would have said if we had covered it. Anyway, so what you see then is a unity, but it's a multi-person unity in this original plan. The unique needs of each other are perfectly supplied. She's a suitable helper, complementary. There's purposeful activity, external activity on the world around me. And finally, there's an implication in that, even in that diagram, you can see with roles and aptitudes. And one thing to look at, kind of look at the woman, and I assert she has a primary role in having children. I think women would all agree with that. But you can see that her world is primarily people-focused. She's a helper to the man, and she is, of course, the primary role of mother there. And for the man, he's kind of perhaps looking outward toward the earth. We'll say some more about that But the idea of the man having the role of interfacing, protecting, whatever, from the outside world as one of his primary roles, I think is beginning to be seen in this relationship, even before the fall. Did this couple have any advantages over us today in their relationship? Now, that's a yes-no question. You can't hardly go wrong with that. Yeah. Everybody's doing this. This is a quiet way of saying it. Marty, I'm still listening. Thank you for that. What were some? Now, that's going to get harder. What was an advantage they might have? Now, this is bad because I have answers. So this is one of those, can you read Marty's mind, what he might have put up there as an answer?
No distractions. Only two of them.
Yeah, it's just two of them. You think he was ever jealous over Adam looking at somebody else? Kind of not likely, right?
Right? He said the only influence was God.
That's an interesting thing. What kind of relationship did they have with God?
Very close.
Oh, yeah, walking in the garden, cool of Eden, yes. Man, would that help a relationship? If you knew God was watching you every minute, you know, I'm not going to do anything, you know, except what he would probably want me to do. You see what I mean? Would that be important? A daily relationship with God. What else? Was Eve the most beautiful woman in the world?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would help, I guess. And if she wasn't, Adam wouldn't know. I mean, there's hardly anybody else better. You see what I'm getting at there? You know, here's another thing I think about, and I'll show you all my answers in just a minute, but this is fun to talk about. You know, I think that we in America probably pictured the ideal family as Leave It to Beaver. Now, I know that I'm too old to bring that up. Somebody here has seen reruns or something. Leave It to Beaver. Y'all know Leave It to Beaver? Yeah. Look at this. Yeah. So who's Ward? He's the dad, right? What does Ward do every morning? He puts on a suit. They always wore suits then.
Goes to work.
Even when they were cutting the grass. And he would get his briefcase, and he'd go to work. He's gone all day. Till the evening, he'd come home, and what was the mom's name?
June
would have her pearls and her dress, all decorated, dining room all set, ready for dinner, and they'd go have dinner. She'd welcome him in, maybe, I don't know, give him a hug or whatever. But that's the way they're family. Is that the ideal family, really? Because poor Ward, where was he all day when Beaver and Wally were getting in trouble? Where was he? He was at work. He wasn't with Jim all day. Now we actually have Jim go off to work every day. And whereas Ward had problems at work that Jim didn't understand, and then people she didn't know, and difficulties she didn't know he had to go through during the day. Now June has them too. Is that ideal? Is that the ideal thing? Or would it maybe be a little more ideal if June and Ward went off to the same place and she helped him all day long doing something together? Is that a possible better situation than the Leave It to Beaver that we think is so ideal in our American culture? And do we make it a little bit worse by putting both of them off in the world somewhere with different situations and different problems and different temptations and different stresses the other doesn't know nothing about, and somehow or another that's going to build a relationship? I'm suggesting to you that the Garden family had this advantage. I think they were together most of the time and working together, planning together, struggling against whatever it is, the struggle is to have dominion together. Okay, that's just Marty's opinion, but you heard some ranting there for a second. But I think that may be one of those things that are there. And lots of other things. You think they ever went hungry? Did they have to fight over the last piece of pie? Or in this case, fruit? You know, the grapefruit that was off their favorite tree? Why not? They never ran out of food. Was there any anxiety, insecurity about running out of food? About who would get the most, who would get the first, who would get the best. None of that. That's just not the... They were in a perfect place. They didn't eat anything. Any tree. Yes?
Clay was gathered around the supper table one night. He was together with family. And Mary, one person eating here, one here.
Oh, yeah, we don't even manage to get together at supper, much less all through the whole day. Yeah, exactly right. Good. And a constant understanding of each other. All right, you're kind of getting the theme of these ideas, and I'm just going to put a bunch of these up, see if you agree with most of them or not. There were no shortages, no anxiety for survival. There was sufficient pleasure to go around. They didn't have to compete with each other about who got the first piece or the last piece, or the most in some place, nor even have anxiety about that. No competition at all. There was immortality, so there's no fear of death or separation. I hope you don't have to live with that too much, but I know what that feels like, to know you're going to lose this person that is kind of your one flesh. That's hard, and it affects things in your life and your relationship. Probably always not for the best, but it's there. There was no other choices, we mentioned. No competition, temptations, unfaithfulness. They were continually together. There was no sin. Boy, can you imagine being married to somebody who had never made a mistake, and they weren't going to, in the sense of betrayal or telling a lie or being in some way cruel in some way. Can you imagine that? Would that help the relationship a little bit? I think it would be unbelievably great. Right? No deception. They were naked. I think maybe there's more to that picture than just they didn't need clothes. I think they just were vulnerable, but it's okay. Neither was going to hurt the other. In any kind of emotional way, and there was no fear of deception. Wouldn't that be great? You just were sure that this other person would always tell the truth. They weren't ashamed. They didn't have guilt that they were carrying around. Does that change a person's character and personality if they're carrying guilt around? Maybe discovered, or maybe it's been discovered, and you keep remembering that because we're such good rememberers, especially of bad things. Close relationship, constant, perfect companionship. You think they were ever lonely? I don't think so. Constant presence of God, someone mentioned, you walked and talked with them. And the other thing related to that is they had obvious value in God's sight. I think one of the things that maybe harms a relationship, someone has some sense of insecurity. A modern, real, catchy phrase is low self-esteem. You think it was a problem in the garden? No, they were in God's image. He had given them dominion over the earth. And a great deal of significance in his sight. And their time was filled with purposeful activity, and they had clear roles. There was no ambiguity or fighting over who was to be in charge or the helper. And the other thing, big thing, no tragedies, no pain. Now, I'm going to quibble with myself on that. Do you think they ever got hungry? When I say pain, I'm kind of quibbling a little bit. I just mean the result of evil and wickedness. But I think they got hungry, right? I think they got sore muscles if they worked hard at the end of the day. But these are good pains, you know. These are the pains that come with doing the right thing. They're not something that make you feel bad. I think that's not what I mean by that. I mean by that the pain that cuts to your heart and separates families and maybe spoils relationships. Sickness and traumas, I suppose, really didn't exist. Wouldn't that be great to live in the garden family? Wouldn't that be great? But, unfortunately, they had some restrictions. How many did they actually have? How many things could they not do? Or could, to say it differently, how many things could they do wrong?
One.
That's kind of true. Right. And where was that tree, by the way? Way off in the corner, somewhere?
In the center.
In the center, right. Not the midst of the garden, in the midst of the garden. It wasn't hidden, it was there, visible, unfortunately, right there. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he commanded them. And actually, you know this command, and it's clear in chapter 3 that they knew it. In fact, Eve repeated it, right? And so it was very clear to them what they could and couldn't do. And I think there's a sense of significance in that. Was it really going to make any difference whether they did or didn't eat one piece of fruit off of a tree somewhere? Did it really matter? Yeah. And I hand out a button. You can press it or not. I don't really care. You know what? You're going to do it. Is that significant? Am I making him significant? Now, no, here's a button. If you press it, the building explodes. Right? Now, am I putting some trust in him and he has a measure of significance he might not have otherwise? Knowing, maybe not fully, but knowing the significance of the consequences of the choice seems to me as a statement of value in God's eyes to them. He was asking them to voluntarily love him, voluntarily obey him, and giving them, miraculously to me, his own created being, the ability to go against his will. I could never make something like that. Now, I can make something that doesn't do what I want it to, but actually I made it that way. If you write software, you know how that works, right? The computer does what you programmed it to do, which may not be the same as what you wanted it to do. Still, in this case, they could disobey what the Creator had said. So I'd like to just, for a minute, look at the consequences of sin more generally. And I think now we're looking at maybe the entire world, and maybe as it's come down to us, to you and me today. With regard to character and conscience, they were in the image of God, they were innocent, they had purpose, they had significance. After the fall, they had guilt and shame. To the extent that they wanted to hide from God, they did not even want to be found by Him. And I think that suggests a deception. Hiding is deception to some extent. And then the stories and alibis and blaming began, you know, as God confronted them as a result of their sin. Before, they had a common work and purpose. They were made of the same flesh. They were one flesh. They were not ashamed, but even though they were vulnerable in some ways. But after the fall, what do we see? Blaming. The serpent. The woman you gave me, God. And corrupted, now a vulnerable man-wife relationship. You can almost see in that initial kind of finger pointing a kind of competitiveness. But did competitiveness enter into the family pretty soon after this, somehow or another? Cain and Abel. I mean, how long does it take until these things start to bear this kind of wicked fruit? They had valuable, meaningful work to do after the fall. How was that work characterized? Thorns, toil, sweat of the face. And they were harmful. They didn't have thorns. You can't eat them. Before, you maybe could have eaten every green thing. You can't eat thorns. But they do worse than that. You know what thorns do in a garden? Right? Where's Luke? He's our gardener. What does a thorn do? It chokes out. In fact, Jesus used some of those metaphors, didn't he? It actually keeps us from growing food that we might need to eat. Not just that we can't eat it. So there are harmful things in the world. When I set out to do something, there are things that get in the way. Joint mission they had together, man and a suitable helper. But 1 Timothy reminds us, no, now they're not actually always helping each other. One is deceiving the other, harming the other in a way in which it's not productive. And so as a result, perhaps, in 1 Timothy 2, a woman is not to have authority over man. Before the fall, they could eat anything except for one thing. Afterward, I think there were lots of shortages, lots of temptation, lots of insecurity, suffering. Not to mention that now we face death. From the dust you came and you can return to the dust. Does that affect the way we look at life? Maybe even affects our relationships and our fear. Either one of us is going to go before the other and all the insecurities that might come with that. Like that picture. Is that the world today? It is. That's where we are. Let's zoom in a little bit on the relationship and the curses that God placed. First on the serpent. And by the way, curses are good or bad things? This is another one of those really hard questions.
Bad
things. Thanks, Paul. So, they're not good. And these are things that are consequences, punishments for what they had done. Not just on them, but consequences on the world. The first one that's mentioned is there will be pain in childbirth, and perhaps maybe even more bearing of children required. I don't know. The language seems to suggest that to me. What was the next thing mentioned? Did anybody remember? In order? To the woman now, who's looking at the woman. Her desire shall be to her husband. That desire is a kind of a, I believe it's a rich and an interesting word, and I'm going to take a kind of a probably speculative position about it. But what does it mean? I'll ask you first, is it a good thing or a bad thing, Kyle?
I say good.
What?
Not good and bad.
I agree with that. It's not good, it's bad. Let's review. Are curses good or bad things?
Bad.
All right, is this a curse?
Oh, it is a curse. Good point. Yeah, bad.
Okay. We're making progress. What does it mean? If it's not, it's not a good thing. What does it mean? Wouldn't you want your wife to desire you somehow or another? So I think one important thing is for us all to, is maybe to look at the Hebrew word behind it. Okay, you ready? To Teshuqah, or something like that. Teshuqah, I believe it's the Hebrew, something like that. And it's only used three times in the Old Testament. Only three times. The other two, they're not. It's not in the feminine form. The others have to do with a man. It's a noun, and it's applied to people. You're probably aware it comes up right away in the very next chapter, where sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you. Right? That doesn't sound like a good desire, really. Here's what Kylan Dalich, either one of the two, I'm not sure which, said about that. The woman had also broken through her divinely appointed subordination to man. She had not only emancipated herself from the man to listen to the serpent, but had led man to sin. For that, she was punished with a desire bordering on disease. And it's from the Hebrew, he says, to have a violent craving for a thing, reaching for a thing. Running after, I think, is maybe the more primitive root, has to do with running towards something. There's some sense in which Eve now, and maybe women generally, wives in particular perhaps, in a relationship, will have this kind of dependency or emotional dependency, desire to reach out and control, to bring in, to hold on to their husband. And I say again, Kyle, you can answer this again if you want. Do you think this is intended to be a good thing or a bad thing?
Bad thing.
Yeah, that's a good answer. So, whatever it is, I don't think it's a good thing. And in some ways it might be unhealthy, because what's the actual curse on the man? First thing it says, he'll rule over you. Again, I don't think that's a good thing for the woman. Whatever it means, I think it perhaps means that in this situation where now there's a competitive world and there's great insecurities, especially for the woman, I think, her desire is really to enfold him, hold him, control him, what she can do to maintain that relationship because of her insecurity. And how does he react to that?
Exploits.
Yeah. I don't like that kind of control. And not only that, I'm going to take advantage of you because I'm able to, as a potential. And sometimes you can almost see that cycle in an abusive relationship. You wonder, why doesn't the woman get out of it or do something? But she keeps coming back. And why does the man keep reacting violently so many times? We can see it on a smaller scale sometimes. Have you ever felt nagged? And the wife is just trying to have a conversation. Why? I think she wants to have a closer relationship with you. And how do you react to that, man, sometimes? You say, well, let's just have a closer relationship. Or a detailed conversation. Or do we sometimes pull away? And if we're not careful controlling ourselves, maybe do things that are harmful, maybe not, but in some way cause a distance to be created. And actually build to that insecurity, which in turn might create that cycle again and create more of those things. Just an idea. Think about it some. So remember that Hebrew word. Can you stare at that and will you recognize it ever comes up again? Because it will. And then finally, man had to toil to take care of the earth. We're going to come back to this tomorrow night. I think that in some ways we leave the story here with the fall. These terrible consequences of the creation. I wonder if there's some way in which these kinds of insecurities, these kind of misbehaviors that resulted as a result of their sin, would somehow be remedied in Christ. Not fully, not permanently, not like when the whole creation, you know, is redeemed, but rather some way that's better. That's what tomorrow night is really about. So, a relationship change within the unity and difficulties with the external environment, pain in childbirth, and toil on the earth. Now, that was the end of the story, right? Nobody ever made mistakes after that. Well, hardly. So you look at the lineage of Cain, and you see Lamech to start out with. He had two wives. It doesn't explain why. I think it's just because he could do it. And he wanted it. Not God's plan, but he did. And others who, you know, began the ownership, the use of technology for entertainment and other things. I'm not saying these are evil in themselves, but the lineage of Cain makes this progress. Lamech comes back and he takes revenge 77-fold, right? If you think Cain maybe was revenged. And Cain was his role model. Doesn't that seem strange to you? You know the story of Cain and Abel. Do sometimes we as men take the role model, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, of those who are really good at getting revenge and creating fear in other people in this fallen world in which if you you don't strike first, maybe you the one that, you know, gets struck. You know what I mean? Is that a possible temptation? And I think we see that playing out here. Lamech kind of got an injury, seemed like minor. And he said, nobody's messing with me again. I'll show you why. And he took revenge and bragged about it. Bragged about it to his wives. Not a great picture. And then, of course, the lineage of Seth, a lot of death. And finally, Methuselah. And then the physical attraction to the sons of men led to what great event? And the world got evil and evil till all the thoughts of man's hearts were evil continually. And God did what?
Flood.
Now that fixed everything. Right? Noah and his sons learned their lessons. No, in fact, we don't have to go many more chapters and we got the Tower of Babel again. Now that fixed everything. You see what's happening is, between generations, what's the natural, and I mean that in the sense of in a fallen world, what is likely, most likely to happen between generations? The children are more conservative, more pious, more moral, more self-controlled than the parents. Is that the way it usually works? I'll look at the young people. Is that an I don't know? No, that's a no. That's a plain out. Yeah. I mean, look, and does that history repeat itself in the nation of Israel? And occasionally there would be one of those, like, all right, we're going into captivity, or some kind of event in which God kind of resets everything, and we get to start over, but then what? There's always the down. Do you ever see that in your life, when you look at like, the next generation, without any kind of major catastrophe intervening? Are the children generally more conservative or less conservative, right? More careful about the scripture, less careful. I hope it can go the other way, and I think it can in a recreated family. But you know what the trend is, right? You need to look at our own country and look at the society's trends in our country to illustrate that. It's not hard to see where we are. So I would just say, I remember in business, in manufacturing, you know, if there was some kind of variable, let's just call it, we want quality, and we want the graph to go like this. In our management meetings, we would flip the graph over and call it scrap and rework so that the graph would go like this. We thought gravity helped with the graph. You know what I mean? But gravity is pulling on the moral character of generations. It always is. That's part of the fallen world is it tends to go down. That's just the way it works in the world without a significant effort, either a reset by God or some kind of change of heart within the people and the leaders. We can see that in the nation of Israel. Attempts, down. Oh, there's Hezekiah. Oh, there's Joseph. You can see some upward trends, but generally a downward. And then I've covered all these already. And I actually have leaked into what I wanted to say with this chart, and then it'll be quarter till, and we'll try to get to the end. Do you feel the results of the fall in your personal life? If you don't, you're not trying hard to be better. Daily personal struggles with evil, with tragedy, with injustice, with a sense of emptiness, with imperfections in myself. In some ways, the more spiritual we are, the more we see how far we are from the pattern of Christ's life. It seems like we should. And confusion about the world, and I won't read all those passages. The children rejection and rebellion against the previous generation, the civil decline of civilization and culture through time, increased opportunity. It seems like every time a new technology is invented, what comes along with it is a new way that that can be used for evil. Maybe good too, but certainly for evil. A new kind of temptation and a new way to undermine our spiritual growth. And then science and governments. I think there's this thought, which is of course, if you just came out of Egypt and that's all you knew and you didn't know the Bible story of the creation and the fall, you might believe some of this stuff, right? I heard a lady from Ukraine, and she was an artist, and you can imagine kind of, I'm sure, a fairly liberal and not really a spiritual thinker. And she was sad and really to the point of tears, and this is what she said, and I thought it was so revealing about her, really. How can this be happening? Y'all know what I'm talking about. She's from Ukraine. This is the 21st century, she said. You see where she is on that? Well, by now, man should have outgrown all that. Is that the way the world works? Is that what we see in the creation account of the fall? No, we see the opposite. And really, if we opened our eyes, and we're just looking at people that were our same color, Mexico or other places in the world, we see the very same thing. The number of genocides in the 20th century, that's the last century, is appalling. If you just look at how many there were around them. But we don't hear that much about that. Appalling, but not surprising. Because that's the nature of the world. And the problem is, I think, especially with the young, is there's this idealism that says, well, you know, the right government, if we just put the right person in office, right? And one side would say, you know what, if we just collected up all the money and rehanded it out so everybody had an equal amount and everybody would feel good and balanced and they treat each other right. And the other side of the room said, no, if we just stopped all this government handout and made everybody earn their living and fend for themselves, and kind of a Darwinistic model, by the way, you know, survival of the fittest, that'd fix society. Is either of those going to fix society? Is any invention of man, technology, government system, economic system, is that going to solve anything? And unfortunately, we had a little class for our young folks about a, we called it modern challenges, thinking that we had challenges today that other people have never had. And true, there are some issues. We tried to cover each of those. And I was amazed myself at how many of them were kind of rooted in a way of ignoring the fall. The fallen nature of the world, I guess is what I'm saying. I mean, here's one. One of the modern issues is our sexuality, right? And if I feel like I'm a girl or if I feel like I'm attracted, that's a natural desire, so it must be good. Wait. You see how that's kind of against this whole model here? No, if it's natural in a fallen world, then it might actually be likely to be wrong, immoral. You see what I mean? But if you forget that, then we have a lot of desires that we shouldn't have because we're in a fallen world and Satan has dominion, really, over this world and temptation. So, yeah, and the same thing about governments. Is it possible that just forcibly taking everybody's money and rehanding it out is going to solve all the problems of the world? Or that any political party or economic system or model of government, especially a democracy, where every, you know, the broad way it comes to mind about the majority is to say what they want to do, is there opportunity for abuse in democracy if we're in a fallen world? I guess so. Is there opportunity for abuse in a dictatorship? Probably. You know, but some sense of confidence in any kind of human system in this fallen world, it seems to me, is ignoring what the Bible's saying about it. I've gone way past 4 to 10. But anyway, you get the idea. But it is the case, if you listen to the parties, whatever their solution is, by whatever spectrum of political conservative or liberalism, is going to claim to solve these kind of inherent problems. And it will not happen, not by man's devising. What we'll see the rest of the weekend is, it actually takes an unusual and unexpected change in the character of people. And I'll go ahead and spill a few beans on that, that cannot be motivated by other than, I believe, the sacrifice of Christ. I'm running way ahead. But what the Bible's asking us to be is something that does not make sense and does not, it's counterintuitive to the world. You know that part. I think that's where we're headed. So I didn't mean to go that far. Here's what I'm going to do. In the last few minutes, I'm not going to talk for maybe a couple of minutes now, and I would like you to look at these consequences over here on the left. We mentioned all those as consequences of the fall. I would like to think in terms of how we could imitate, simulate, almost recreate that garden environment that would have been so wonderful, even now, by the way we live. Is that a possibility? No hints on this, but I'm just saying, I don't know, you can't live forever, so death is always on there. But is there something you can do to help mitigate the effects of the fall in the way we live, the way we treat each other, the way we structure our families and what we do? Y'all see what I'm getting at here? So I'm not going to talk for a couple of 3 minutes. I wish you would talk to each other. And I'm going to suggest maybe that this side of the room start at the bottom and work up. This middle part, why don't y'all work in the middle here, and you all start at the top and try to get 2 or 3 thought about and discuss, and then I'd like to hear some of your answers. Is that assignment clear? I want to fill in the right-hand side of the chart. And again, it's one of those read Marty's mind exercises. I'm sorry about that. But over here, how would you recreate, in some small sense, maybe think of it as just mitigating some of the severity of the consequences. How how would you recreate, simulate, do something, to try to eliminate some of the consequences that are real in the world? Okay, I'll try to be quiet.
We're supposed to do the little ones?
Yes, this, yeah, so start with maybe no sin, little temptation, no sin. I'm just saying in our families, this is what we deal with. What can we do? Maybe dads, as leaders of the family, or couples, parents, what can we do to try to make that less harmful? Do you understand the assignment now? I used to say that in math. Does everybody understand that? And who is going to answer no to that? As we go. All right. Probably not so much now in this time, but there are shortages in the world. There are people all over there anxious for survival. But we all kind of fight over who gets their way for the fun TV show to watch or whatever that is. And so they had no competition in the garden. What can we do in our families to try to eliminate this competition for things? You know, getting our way. I always think of the best piece of the pie or something like that. But what can we do? Good. Let's see, who started at the top? You guys did, right? What do you got? What can you do?
Watch out.
Okay. Okay, there's this unselfishness that really ought to characterize our behavior. Even to the point that it hurts me. Right. And that's a hard thing in this world. Not looking out for myself. Implement that, right? Sacrificial care for others is ourselves. Is that something we can do imperfectly but better every day? I think. How about immortality? No fear of death or separation. Y'all figure out how to first not to be immortal? Yes. God?
God will raise us from the dead, so you don't have to worry about.
You know, living with that hope is the right word for it, I suppose, but faith, assurance. That should really help us overcome this fear of separation, this fear of disaster. When this life is over, that's all they're lost. That's all they're lost. And the person is gone and they're dead all over, and that's it. There's a full commitment to the permanence of relationship. You know, that's a little different answer. I guess what I thought about that was, why don't we just really be fully committed to having the relationship as long as we can? And it's as permanent as I can make it till death does part us here. Sorry, I'm showing my answer. No other choices, say, for a wife. No competition, no temptations to unfaithfulness. They didn't have any of that in the garden. How can we recreate that or simulate that or mitigate that?
Contentment.
Okay, with?
With godliness.
Okay.
Limiting. Inappropriate relationships.
Absolutely. Put those barriers there, right? And don't talk about them. Don't make comparisons that are unfair. That's a behavior we could have that I think begins to eliminate this temptation unfaith. So the commitment, no competitions and no comparisons. How about continual contact? And no other competing influences or distractions. I guess we should talk Ward into getting another job. What can we do with that? In our families.
I thought if the need is there to be separated for a time, then when you come back together, give time for connecting.
Okay, so it's kind of a repair remedy if there is a separation. But generally, how about minimizing separations to start with? I just think that's so important for families. I mean, I hear about families that have separate vacations, and they're, you know, they go off, husband and wife, because they like different things. What? That may be the only time you're really together all day long. And I think certainly taking a job or position, are we in control of that? Can we actually change our jobs in this country, at least for the most part? Yeah. Would you change your job just because it gave you more time at home? More time with the wife? Less uncertainty? So she had access to where? I unfortunately worked in facilities that you had to have a clearance to get in. There, I worked for 10 years in an office that my wife was not allowed to see. She never saw it. I don't think that was healthy for our relationship. Can you see why? She didn't know what I was dealing with all day long, where I was. Sometimes couldn't even be reached because I wasn't there where you could have come. I regret that, just to be honest. I don't think that's... And are there some jobs that are like that? They're so consuming that you're just out of touch and out of reach. Would we change our jobs for the sake of making our families better? We're getting ahead of ourselves, but I wonder if you think that clearly about it. So, home is the primary place and time. And certainly when we are together, you know my point. I mean, I just zoned out on it. I did something else. When we're together, let's be together and turn off devices and do things that have to do with rich and full communication and so on. You see how this works? I think I'm down to the middle section here. No sin, little temptation, no personal hurt or causes for grudges. I'm sorry that I put this up there, but living pure lives. You know, so forgiveness would help with the guilt that some people carry around. Asking for forgiveness, genuinely asking often. What about no deception, no fear of deception? What'd y'all come up with for that?
Being honest and transparent.
Yeah, in every way. Open. Open email, open texts, open...
Talk to each other openly every day.
Right. And in a way that's not deceptive at all. I think that's the key idea. There should be nothing to hide from, as Adam and Eve did after they sinned. There's nothing to hide. There should be everything open, communication, everything. Expenses, all of that. I've done some of these things with old men and young men kind of in the same room, and I'd say, you know, you should have common checking accounts and savings. We shouldn't be like his and hers. And the old guys are going, yeah. The young guys are going, what? Turning white, you know, what? Separate accounts. I wonder if there's not an opportunity for even deception and things, even in some of that independent honesty, independent banking and so on. Not ashamed. Can we mitigate that? We've all done things we shouldn't have done. We're all inadequate in lots of ways. And it's known best by those who are closest to us, by the way. What can we do to eliminate this shame or embarrassment in front of the people who know what we've done?
Forgiveness.
Isn't that a key word? Accept them as they are. No criticism, no ridicule, no complaint. Not as they are in sin, but I mean by that, if they're inadequate at something, you just accept them. No criticism, ridicule, and of course forgiveness. As we mentioned, like two up there. Y'all are doing good at putting different answers than Marty's. I think that's okay, I think we're ready for this side. Close, constant, perfect companionship and no loneliness. They never had to say goodbye. And I remember going back to the one before, asking for forgiveness. You remember, y'all, there was some movie, The Love Story. It was real popular when I was kind of high school, college age. You remember the motto of that movie? You may. Oh, yeah. Sandra, what was it? And that's the dumbest thing. Love means you never have to say you're sorry. I think it might mean you don't have to explain your inadequacies. You're accepted the way you are. It does not mean that you never apologize for anything. That's the opposite, right? Okay, I'll go ahead and put some of these up here. Although I think y'all have better answers than I'm going to put. So help me if I'm missing any. I think you build and exercise strong in communication channels. What about the constant presence of God? We don't have that. He doesn't walk and talk with us in the cool of the evening. I wonder if there's a way in which he can talk to us and we can talk to him on a regular basis. And so that the sense of presence and God's awareness of our actions and thoughts is kind of in the front of our mind more, which it would have been for him. Obvious value, we treat others with respect in Ephesians 5. Subject yourselves one to another. Time filled with purposeful activities. I think we set family goals and chores together. We work together where everybody can contribute and feel appreciated for what they've done. And I don't think we can do away with tragedies, pain, and sickness, but I think we can kind of prevent some measures of disappointment, but primarily build a trust in God. I heard a sermon talked about how do you deal with tragedies. And part of it is to think about in advance that it's likely to happen, and think through the response. What will be hard? What will you do? Who needs to be helped the most? Those kind of things, you can anticipate that. That might be some way to do that. Do you see the algorithm I'm trying to create here? The specific answers are not the main point of what I was trying to say. God made a perfect family. What a blessing to know about that. And it was broken. And we even know some of the ways in which it was broken that affect us even today. Can we reason backward from that to look at what God had in mind in the family and try to recreate that in our own families? That's wonderful. That's what's what tonight is about. Tomorrow night, I'm going to look reason forward and say, what did Christ bring in that helps us with these problems, the effects of the fall? And we'll be looking at Ephesians 4:5. That's tomorrow night. I'm done. Oh, sorry. But one song and then a prayer.